I just kept going into the jungle. I could see bodies all over.
While you're running, they're still shooting.
I'm still hearing shots.
They had identified people they wanted to kill.
We were on top of a powder keg.
It's almost impossible to fathom, even now. More than 900 Americans dead in the jungle at Jonestown.
It was something out of a horror movie.
You're telling me this man said, drink this poison?
Yeah.
And they drank it?
That's right.
We take you inside the mission that exposed the dangerous truth.
Don't you touch my kids!
And I'm thinking, oh my God, it's true. Everything we feared is true.
The only video camera there to capture it all belonged to NBC News.
He said, I can never put this camera down.
Rare pictures and powerful details from those who survived.
They were shooting point blank.
My whole shirt was just dripping with red blood.
All of a sudden, I was hit. I thought, oh my God, this is it.
A riveting look at the story that still haunts the world.
The enormity of it all.
And the insanity of it.
It still comes up and you just can't push it down.
I'm Lester Holt, and this is Dateline. Here's Josh Mankiewicz with Jonestown, an American tragedy.
It is a moment frozen in time. A group of journalists posed on a jungle airstrip in South America. One day later, three of these men and the U.S. congressman they were traveling with would be murdered by members of an American cult. A few miles away, hundreds of members of that cult would also perish in an orgy of mass murder and suicide.
Good evening. In one of the strangest cases of mass suicide and murder ever recorded, the government of Guyana said today...
This is the story behind the story of an American tragedy called Jonestown, as it was recorded and reported by the journalists of NBC News.
We do have a particular interest in it. Two NBC newsmen were shot to death there.
Our story begins in San Francisco in the mid-70s, where a charismatic preacher named Jim Jones was making a name for himself and attracting a particular flock.
He considered himself a socialist, and San Francisco is a very liberal community.
Tim Reiterman was a young wire service reporter at the time.
He was perceived as an activist preacher, somebody who practiced what he preached, somebody who brought in poor people and helped poor people.
Jones had migrated to California from the Midwest in the 60s, preaching a gospel of racial harmony and communal living. In San Francisco, his People's Temple ran elderly homes, offered drug counseling, and fed the poor. Jones was a darling of Democrats. Politicians like Mayor George Moscone and Governor Jerry Brown courted him. But the Reverend Jim Jones was also controversial. He claimed to be Christ, reincarnated, a socialist God who could heal the sick, make the blind see, and the lame walk again.
Jones had established a reputation as a faith healer, as someone who could remove cancers from people's bodies. And much of this was, of course, fakery, but it did bring people through the door.
While researching a story about Jones for the San Francisco Examiner, Reiterman says he met with former followers who told him hair-raising stories about Jones that differed from the public image. Stories of disciplinary beatings and public humiliations.
On one occasion that was described, he had a woman in the inner circle disrobe in front of everybody so that they could make fun of her body.
This was also discipline, teaching somebody a lesson.
Yeah, basically do away with your ego. Identify with the group alone.
Jones had to have known if reporters were closing in, trouble wasn't far behind. So in the summer of 77, shortly before press reports critical of the People's Temple were to be published, Jim Jones left town. He resurfaced thousands of miles away at a jungle compound the temple had established in Guyana, a small country on the northeastern edge of South America.
Why Guyana, of all places?
Well, for one reason, Guyana is an English-speaking country. And it's small enough and poor enough that the temple's financial resources would buy a welcome.
Over the next few months, Jones brought roughly 1,000 of his followers there.
What a swing! What liberation brings!
In promotional films, Jones portrayed his Jonestown settlement
with noodles, chow mein noodles, couldn't go through all the Kool-Aid,
as a tropical paradise.
American manners are nothing like these.
And the new settlers urged family and friends to join them there.
It'll be nice when things get worked around that you can come down and share our freedom, complete freedom here in the Promised Land.
Armadillos are almost blind.
The Guyana move abruptly divided many families. Jones's followers gave up property and paychecks to the temple. And according to former members, Jones demanded that those moving to Jonestown surrender their passports. Families brought their concerns to Bay Area Congressman Leo Ryan.
Complaints from constituents prompted him to form a fact-finding mission to find out whether the people who were living in Jonestown, including the children, were free to leave or not.
And Congressman Ryan went down there to see what was really true.
Exactly.
And you went with it.
Exactly. I essentially invited myself along.
It was shortly before the 1978 midterm elections that NBC News assigned correspondent Don Harris and a camera crew to accompany Ryan to Guyana.
What first impressed me in meeting the NBC crew was that they were all experienced, some had covered wars.
With little time to prepare, Harris dove into the Jonestown story. He interviewed Temple's supporters, critics, and high-profile defectors like Grace Stone.
But you have to understand, my ignorance is so great at this point. I'm doing research at the same time we're doing the taping, which is a tough way to operate, but there just wasn't enough time to do the homework.
Well, I just want to tell you one thing. You will never meet up with another man like Jim Jones. I'm telling you the truth.
With grim foreshadowing, Debbie Layton Blakey, a defector, told Harris that Jones sometimes ordered his followers in Guyana to drink from a vat that supposedly contained poison.
Everyone stood in a line, went up and drank this red, you know, it was kind of a, tasted like, what's this, that thing, the drink little children drink, but you have to put a lot of sugar in it first.
Kool-Aid?
Kool-Aid, without sugar. That's what it was, I don't know, but you know, it had a horrible taste initially, and you could have think, well, maybe there is something in that. He said it will take 45 minutes, and he assigned several people to faint or to pretend they were dead.
How many people would you say were there then?
Between 11 and 1,200 people.
You're telling me this man took 1,100 people and gathered them together?
Well, he does every day, yeah.
And said, drink this poison.
Yeah.
And they drank it?
That's right.
You drank it.
Yeah.
Just before leaving for Guyana, cameraman Bob Brown called his wife, Connie, and said this about his latest assignment.
He says, you know, if these people are very strange, but if half of what they're saying is true, this is a terrible story. This is incredible.
When we come back, the first look inside Jonestown.
We see people all line up in the big pavilion.
When we met him the first day there, he struck me as just evil personified.
I'm thinking, oh my God, it's true. Everything we feared is true.
When Dateline continues.
When NBC's news crew packed for the trip to Guyana in November 1978, this is what they carried. 70 pounds of camera gear. At the time, that was state-of-the-art. And boxes full of clunky 20-minute videotapes. Sound tech Steve Sung did much of the heavy lifting.
I had to carry the tape deck. It weighs about, 35, 40 pounds, maybe 35 pounds. And there's no remote control. It's just video feed directly into machine.
So you got to be connected to the cameraman at all times?
All time.
8 journalists would enter Jonestown with Congressman Ryan, half of them from NBC News. Cameraman Bob Brown had worked for all 3 networks, covering riots, shootouts, and war.
I'll tell you what Bob told my brother before we went to Vietnam.
Brown's wife, Connie.
Nick said to him, "How can you go into a war zone without a gun?" And Bob said, "Well, first off, I figure if it's that bad, there'll be guns lying around. But if I don't have a gun, I can assure you I'm going to get the picture of the damn son of a bitch who shoots me."
Like Brown, correspondent Don Harris had covered riots at home and war in Vietnam.
The M16s are old and battered, but they say they have enough ammunition.
He always said, "It's going to be okay. You know, I'll be fine."
Shirley Oliver heard a lot of that during her 20-year marriage to Don.
I tried not to worry too much. He was in Vietnam for 5 weeks on the front line, and they called him Mr. Lucky because he always came back.
Leading the NBC team was veteran field producer Bob Flick.
He was a big, tall, strong, full of a man.
San Francisco Chronicle reporter Ron Javers.
Wore a T-shirt that said, "God Rides a Harley," and had a big white golf cap, and we bonded, you know, right away.
Along with Javers and Reiterman were Washington Post reporter Charles Krause and San Francisco Examiner photographer Greg Robinson.
He says, "I got it. It looks like I'm going to South America. I'm going to do an assignment there."
Greg's sister, Andrea Robinson.
I said, "Are you serious? That's incredible." We were both so excited.
It took 26 hours for the Ryan entourage to travel from San Francisco to Georgetown, Guyana. But once there, Jim Jones refused to let them visit his compound.
"I still hope we can work out something between Mr. Jones and I."
For 3 days, they waited while the congressman negotiated with Temple lawyers. NBC correspondent Don Harris interviewed concerned relatives like Jim Cobb.
"What are you doing down here?"
"Well, I'm here essentially to try to see my relatives. I have a mother, 3 sisters, and a brother that I haven't seen my sisters or brothers in about 4 years now."
28-year-old Jackie Speer was Congressman Ryan's legislative aide. She'd helped arrange the Jonestown trip and knew enough to be afraid.
"I was concerned about making that trip."
Temple defector she'd interviewed had told her Jonestown was a virtual prison camp, a place where members were brainwashed, armed, and willing to kill for Jim Jones.
"I was in the process of purchasing a condo, my first home in Arlington, Virginia, and I literally made the contract contingent on my surviving the trip."
"Almost like you had some omen?"
"Almost like I had a premonition about it."
It was Friday, November 17th, 1978, when Jim Jones finally agreed to see the Ryan group.
"So far, so good."
After landing in Port Kaituma, a small village a few miles from Jonestown, the Ryan group was taken the rest of the way in the back of a Temple dump truck. It was after dark by the time the reporters finally arrived in Jonestown. Too dark to see anything except what Jim Jones wanted them to see.
"We see people all line up in the big pavilion. They welcome us to come in. They start with the music, singing, like welcoming party for us."
So at that point, it's kind of what you thought. It's everybody's happy.
You can see the videotape. The people are happy and they will welcome us to come in.
They had some very good musicians down there who did some really good music.
Washington Post reporter Charles Krause.
But I also noticed that there were people who were like comatose, who were, you know, clapping, but without any kind of, nothing related to the music.
That's a pretty clear sign that everything maybe isn't as it seems.
That's right.
Presiding over all of it was Jim Jones.
When we met him the first day there in Jonestown, he struck me as just evil personified. And we were almost sure that he was on drugs. And at one point, he had asked his wife, Marceline, to give me a pill. And she was overheard saying, no, no pills.
In the spirit of the moment, Congressman Ryan took to the stage and complimented his hosts.
I can tell you right now that from the few conversations I've had with some of the folks here already this evening, that whatever the comments are, there are some people here who believe that this is the best thing that ever happened in their whole life.
And everybody cheers. Right. And the sense you get is, well, everything's fine.
Well, it was almost a manic cheering, almost to the point that it made you a little uncomfortable.
It was during that raucous applause that someone passed a note to NBC correspondent Don Harris. The note, signed by two people, read simply, "Please help us get out of Jonestown."
Don brings this note over to us and says, "You might want to see this." And Leo Ryan looks at it and then hands it to me, and I'm thinking, oh my God, it's true. Everything we feared is true.
Don Harris's son, Jeff Humphrey, was 17 when his father went to Guyana. He believes he knows exactly how his father responded to that note.
Well, this is my dad's NBC News notebook. It says it's Jonestown on the front of it. He was trying to write this note to somebody without anybody else knowing about it, and it says, "Find me tomorrow. Whether you find me or not, I'll help."
Coming up.
Don't bring those kids back here!
Word started to get out that people were leaving.
Division in the compound. Danger was just ahead.
Suddenly, the knife was around my neck.
When Dateline continues.
After the show was over that first night, Jones insisted the reporters return to Port Kaituma, where he'd arranged for them to sleep in a local bar.
So we ended up sleeping on the floor.
There would be little rest. While the NBC crew had a nightcap at the bar, Tim Reiterman and the other print reporters were approached by a local constable who wanted to talk about Jonestown.
He said that on multiple occasions, there were people who were evacuated from Jonestown or flown out of Port Kaituma after receiving injuries, and he felt that some of them had been beaten. And he described a pit.
What do you mean a pit?
A deep hole in the ground that people couldn't climb out of. You'd be placed in it for punishment.
The next morning, the print reporters told Don Harris about the pit, and Harris showed them the note he'd gotten the night before.
And he kind of rolled down his combat boot that he had on, and in there was a white tablet note about that big. It said, "Please help us get out of Jonestown."
By the time the newsmen passed through the temple gates later that morning, they were no longer a collection of rivals. They were a team.
I think I said, "Let's just each of us fan out and each reporter get as much stuff as you can get, and then we'll get together again and we'll share it all." Everybody said, "Absolutely."
But temple monitors shadowed their every step, making it impossible for reporters to speak privately with Jonestown residents like Maria Katsaris.
Are you happy here?
Yes, I'm very happy here.
You know that your father and your brother are convinced that you're not.
Well, I'm very happy here. I don't know what else I can do to convince them.
Her brother, Anthony, who flew in with the Ryan group, wasn't so sure.
It's hard for me to know what to think. For me to be satisfied, I'd have to see you somewhere else.
We're just a news team. We don't care one way or the other. Are you happy here?
Oh, I should say I am. I've never been any happier in my life.
Her son, Jim Cobb, was skeptical.
Are you satisfied that they are not under duress at this moment, that they can talk to you?
That's they can't. Well, and yeah, no, they can't. They can't talk with me right now, sure. Yeah.
Back at the main pavilion, however, other residents were stepping forward to tell Jackie Spear that they wanted out of Jonestown.
And your name is Brenda Parks. Brenda Parks. And what is your pleasure? What is your wish today? To go back home.
Word started to get out that people were leaving, and then more people wanted to leave.
Congressman Ryan said he was willing to take anyone who wanted to leave. And though Jim Jones pleaded with the defectors to stay, their minds were made up.
Just know that we is our place for you.
Running short on time, Harris and the NBC crew set up to tape their interview with Jim Jones.
Last night, someone came and passed me this note.
That's who we're talking about. He wants to leave his son here. If Jones sounds such a bad place, why does he want to leave his son here? He's the one that I'm just talking about. This is the man that wants to leave his son here.
Doesn't it concern you, though, that this man, for whatever reason, one of the people in your group,
play games, friend. They lie. What can I do about liars? Are you people going to leave us? I just beg you, please leave us.
And then all of a sudden, the skies just turned dark, and it just dumped this torrential rain, and it was almost like some sort of evil omen.
Sign from above.
It struck everybody that way. It was just so eerie.
When the rain let up, the mood turned ugly, as families divided over whether to stay or go.
You bring those kids back here!
Hold on a second.
You bring them back!
One second.
Don't you touch my kids!
As Congressman Ryan stayed behind to take care of some last-minute logistics, a dump truck loaded with reporters and defectors pulled away for the trip to the airstrip.
And then a shout went up from the people behind us. And you could hear this, "Wow, what are they doing?" You know.
And Leo Ryan came out of the pavilion heading towards us. His shirt was all bloody.
The congressman had been attacked by a temple member who'd held a knife to Ryan's throat. The congressman was unharmed, but in the struggle over the knife, his attacker was cut. Ryan was clearly shaken as he climbed into the truck for the trip to the airstrip.
We get our airstrip, we unload it, get ready. Of course, the plane hasn't there yet. So the press people decide to have a press conference with Congressman.
Suddenly, the knife was around my neck, and I was in danger.
After his interview with the congressman, Don Harris seemed to sense trouble coming.
And Don Harris come and push against me, say, "Hey, get a wide shot, get away, there must be trouble. Okay, you guys get ready."
Three men, who Harris knew to be close to Jim Jones, suddenly approach as if looking for someone. After conferring briefly, Sung says, the men waved away bystanders and walked toward a red tractor that had just pulled up.
Don Harris knew something was going on.
Yes, Don Harris knew exactly there's something going on.
Coming up, gunshots on the airstrip.
We dive on the ground.
They were shooting point blank.
My whole shirt was just dripping with red blood.
I was playing dead, and all of a sudden, I was hit.
When Dateline continues.
The reporters had their story. In less than 24 hours, they'd interviewed Jim Jones, witnessed more than a dozen defections, and an assassination attempt on a U.S. congressman.
I think I may put on the tape just that I told you, so never mind.
As NBC cameraman Bob Brown rolled tape, two planes were being prepared for takeoff. And then suddenly, gunshots. Only this snippet of that moment remains.
We dive on the ground, both of us, because we're really connected to each other.
With that cable.
With the cable. We, like marriage, cannot be separated.
I saw Ryan running under the plane. I followed suit, and I hid behind one of the wheels.
Pop, 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 pop. And I had never heard a gunshot before in my life.
Bob Brown was shooting at the truck with gunfire go off. And next thing, he got shot in the leg. He sat up and said, "Ouch." I said, "Don't get up." He did. And that's why he drew attention. They blew his head off. Next shot.
Bob Brown was dead. True to his word, Brown, it seemed, did get a shot of the man who killed him. A few feet away, Steve Sung was still tethered to Brown's camera.
They hit my shoulder, they had a big scar on my arm, and I was carrying a heavy case. The leather strap saved me.
The big leather strap.
That saved my life.
I felt myself get shot in the left arm and wrist.
When you get hit with a rifle bullet, it knocked me on my ass.
Neither Javers nor Reiterman stayed down for long. Both sprinted for cover in the jungle.
And while you're running, they're still shooting.
I'm still hearing shots.
My whole shirt was just dripping with red blood.
On the airstrip, the killing continued.
I was playing dead, and all of a sudden, I was hit. And I thought, oh my God, this is it. I'm dying.
Nearby, Congressman Ryan was down, severely wounded.
They were shooting point blank at us there on the ground.
That's when you were hit.
And that's when I was hit, but and that's when the congressman was killed.
I was told Ryan was shot dozens of times.
I was told he was shot 45 times. They had identified people they wanted to kill.
Congressman Leo Ryan, dead. Nearby, another target, NBC correspondent Don Harris, also murdered. Across the airstrip, a Temple gunman who'd pretended to be a defector opened fire, wounding two passengers on the smaller plane. When his gun jammed, the other passengers disarmed him. The attack had lasted only a couple of minutes, and then silence. The reporters who'd made it into the jungle slowly crept back toward the airstrip.
And there was the happiest sight I'd ever seen. There was Bob Flick, with his big white hat, and his God Rides a Harley white T-shirt. Bob was going around kneeling down from one person to the next.
I worked my way out to the plane, and Greg Robinson was near the gangway. He was dead. And Congressman Ryan, he was dead. Bob Brown was a short distance away, and he was dead. Don Harris was nearby, too. And near the gangway, Patricia Parks, who was one of the defectors, died.
Five dead, 10 wounded. Shortly after the shooting stopped, the Guyanese pilots left in the only plane that could still fly, leaving the wounded to fend for themselves.
I should have died on that airstrip. I should have. But it was not part of the plan. I mean, my whole right side of my leg was blown up, except for the femoral artery. Had the femoral artery been severed, I would have died in 90 seconds.
You had to be wondering whether you were going to bleed to death.
I think it was a Tim Redman. He used a T-shirt to tie to a, what do you call the word?
Tourniquet.
Tourniquet, yeah. So stop the blood bleeding. He's helped me save me that way.
Bob Flick came a number of times during the night and brought me Guyanese rum to take.
Which was the closest thing to medicine they had.
Right. And I was forever grateful to him for doing that.
While the rest of the survivors waited for help in a rum shop near the airstrip, some of the Jonestown defectors darkly speculated about what might be happening in Jonestown at that very moment.
Someone was saying, and I remember this, you know, they're killing them, man. They're killing all the babies.
Coming up, a journey back to Jonestown. The world was about to learn the unimaginable truth.
It was something out of a horror movie.
When Dateline continues.
On Sunday morning, November 19th, roughly 16 hours after the airstrip shootings, two small planes arrived in Port Kaituma to evacuate the survivors back to Georgetown for medical treatment. Just beyond the jungle horizon, a killing field was waiting to be discovered. But for Tim Reiterman, all that mattered in that moment was documenting the scene in front of him.
I couldn't find my small compact camera, so I went through Greg Robinson's bag. I found one that had some film left in it, and I took a picture. It's that photo you see of the plane with the bodies around it.
On the flight out of Port Kaituma, Ron Javers sat next to NBC producer Bob Flick.
Bob was holding the blue NBC minicam to his chest. He wasn't saying anything. He looked like hell. He was, you know, just sweating. And I said, Bob, you can put the camera down now. He just looked at me and said, I can never put this camera down. And it's just streaming tears.
Within hours of the airstrip ambush, NBC sent fresh correspondents and crews to Guyana.
I had to pick up that video and put that video on television.
Former NBC correspondent Fred Francis.
How could this possibly happen? This is not a war zone. This is in the middle of a jungle where there are mostly Americans around you.
In Georgetown the next morning, Flick recounted the slaughter of the night before.
There were many shots, and every time somebody would fall down wounded, they would walk over and shoot him in the head with a shotgun.
As Bob Flick boarded his flight home, the story that had left him so shaken exploded in a new unthinkable horror.
It's a nightmare.
According to Temple members who'd escaped from Jonestown overnight, Jim Jones had ordered his followers to swallow a fruit-flavored drink laced with cyanide.
When you ran, were people already dying?
Yeah, when I ran, yeah.
Remember, days earlier in San Francisco, defector Debbie Layton Blakey had described something that now sounded like a rehearsal.
You're telling me this man said, drink this poison?
Yeah.
And they drank it?
That's right.
According to Jonestown escapee Odell Rhodes, anyone who resisted was forced to take the poison.
There was a little girl named Julie Reynolds that was being forced to take it. She was about 13, I guess. And the woman who supervised her and one of the nurses were actually forcing her to take it because she kept spitting it out, and they were forcing her to take it.
Fred Francis knew he had to get to Jonestown.
Nobody would fly me to Jonestown. And then I found the airplane with the bullet holes in it, and I negotiated a price of $10,000 with the pilot to fly me out there. And part of that fee was to the ground staff of that airport that nobody else should fly out of there after us.
So you're protecting your exclusive.
I spent $8,000 on a pilot and $2,000 to close the airport to any other pilots. Works for me.
Once he landed at Port Kaituma, Francis says he and his crew hitched a ride to Jonestown on an American Army helicopter.
When we started rotating in a helicopter, the Army helicopter over Jonestown, we could see this massive quilt. We had no idea what we were looking at. And as the helicopter made another pass and we got closer, the stench came up, even with the rotor wash, into the plane. And then we realized what we were looking at were hundreds of bodies down below us.
Lying on top of one another.
It was something out of a horror movie. We couldn't tell whether they were men or women or children until we got on the ground. And that's when we had to use the perfume and the scarves.
This is the way Fred Francis reported that story in 1978.
When the poison was being passed out, men were around this auditorium area here with crossbows. They were acting as guards. If anyone tried to leave, these were used.
I remember walking through Jonestown and being stunned, being emotionally blasted.
Stays with you.
Yeah, the kids. You know, adults are going to do what they want. But children, they took 304 kids and killed them. It's amazing.
Coming up, one more unbelievable discovery. The madness of it all, captured on tape.
They'll torture some of our children here. We cannot have this.
It still comes up and you just can't push it down.
When Dateline continues.
It was a gruesome crime scene. Hundreds of bodies stacked three and four deep in places, pungent in the stifling heat.
The government of Guyana told the United States late in the day that it wants the bodies of the victims returned to the United States for burial.
It would take weeks for American soldiers to recover all of those bodies and ship them home. In the end, 909 bodies were found at Jonestown. Investigators determined Jim Jones and his nurse died of gunshot wounds, likely self-inflicted. All the rest, it seemed, either drank the poison or had it injected.
And it wasn't a painless death.
Former NBC correspondent Fred Francis.
Some of those who escaped talked about how the people were withering around the pavilion, how it took some of them many minutes to die.
Add in the 5 dead from the airstrip ambush and 4 more from another location, and the total death tally was 918. It was while combing the compound for clues that investigators made another discovery. Jim Jones had actually recorded Jonestown's final death scene.
How very much I've tried my best to give you the good life.
Recorded shortly after the murders of Congressman Ryan and 4 others at the airstrip. Jones tells his followers that suicide is their only option now.
The congressman's dead. Please get us the medication. It's simple.
According to Jones, the Guyanese Army, or GDF, would soon be arriving to destroy their paradise.
Please get it. Before it's too late, the GDF will be here. I tell you, get moving, get moving, get moving. Don't be afraid to die. If these people land out here, they'll torture some of our children here. They'll torture our people. They'll torture our seniors. We cannot have this.
According to eyewitnesses, the children were the first to die.
Where's the vat with the green tea in, please? Right here, so the adults can begin.
Just before the tape ran out, Jones can still be heard, pleading for obedience, rationalizing madness.
We didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide protesting the conditions of an inhumane world.
Among the dead, Maria Katsaris and Jim Cobb's mother, brother, and 3 sisters. Today, this mass grave in Oakland is the final resting spot for more than 400 of Jonestown's dead.
Oh, no.
For the survivors, Jonestown became a life-defining event. After nearly dying on that airstrip, Jackie Speer is following in Congressman Leo Ryan's footsteps.
He was a great mentor, I learned a great deal from him.
And you have a seat now.
And now I'm serving in his seat. It is bittersweet, obviously.
The reporters who survived the airstrip ambush all wrote books about it. After Jonestown, Bob Flick left TV News and had a second career with Entertainment Tonight. He died in 2015. Steve Sung became an editor and occasionally worked on stories for Dateline. Steve's retired now.
Fred Francis, NBC News.
Fred Francis went on to have many big assignments in his 40-year career at NBC News. But he says Jonestown is the one story he just can't shake.
This one always seems to poke at me every now and again. The enormity of it all, you know.
And the insanity of it.
The insanity of it. And that smell, even though I couldn't resurrect it, it's with me all the time. I mean, it was so powerful.
The dead remain ageless in the minds of those they left behind. Bob Brown's widow, Connie Brown Henderson.
Bob has now been dead longer than he was alive, but he sure packed a lot into 36 years.
Photographer Greg Robinson, who took many of the iconic Jonestown pictures, was only 27 when he was murdered.
See, even this late... later, it still comes up and you just can't push it down. It's so bizarre.
His sister Andrea still struggles with his loss and the thoughts of what might have been.
We both had plans to have our lives together. All those dreams were just shattered.
Don Harris left behind a trunk full of memories for his family. Among the most prized is this letter from one of the airstrip survivors.
And he wrote this letter to my mom.
Even at the very end, my dad, took the time to help me.
As I lay crouched behind the wheel of the airplane, Don told me, "Don't move, don't make a sound. Just be still and pretend like you're dead." I can't understand why I'm alive. One more time. He said, "I can't understand why I'm alive and such a fine man like your husband isn't."
It's been more than four decades, but like much of what happened at Jonestown, it's a question with no answer.